Hey, folks, you're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast, and you're listening only to a third of what we did this week. You want more? Well, easy to get. Head over to rofpodcast.com. Sign up to become a member. It is just a couple of bucks a week. And frankly, it is our primary source of revenue for this show. Without our members, we could not continue to produce even the free part of this podcast, never mind the three-hour show that goes out to over 40 stations across the country. Folks need to hear other perspectives besides right-wing radio, and this is the way we do it. Will you help us in this commitment? Head over to rofpodcast.com. And thanks for your support. Thanks for listening. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Today on the show, Christina Lopez from Media Matters will join us to discuss the real story about ICE agents and how they're terrorizing people around the country. Investigative journalist David Dayan will explain how prosecutors and judges have brought back debtor prisons. Heather Digby Parton from Salon will be here to break down this week's biggest news stories. And we'll talk to Nivedita Majumdar about her piece in Jacobin magazine, The Socialist Case for Gun Control. Don't forget, you can go to rofpodcast.com, sign up for the free one-hour version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. And if you want the full show, commercial-free, become a member. That's the best way to support this program. That's rofpodcast.com. Here to help me analyze the biggest news stories of the week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her from her blog, Hullabaloo, Digby. So Heather, a lot of news this week, as is been the case for really, I guess, the past year and a half or so. But let's start with some very positive news. It is, I guess there is some question as to how much Donald Trump is involved in this, but I think that's like a second order or a third order question. But what I'm talking about is the biggest strike by public sector workers in almost 30 years took place in West Virginia over the past almost 2 weeks. They resolved it earlier this week. West Virginia teachers went on strike. They were the 48th out of 50th lowest paid teachers in the country. They live in a state where there is no right for collective bargaining per se. And it's basically a right to work for less state. Their strike was technically unlawful, meaning not that they could go get arrested for striking, but that if the school districts decided to enjoin them from striking, they could have, and that would have left the union itself open to some lawsuits. But they won their strike this week after about 3 or 4 days after the union leadership had come to a deal and the rank and file had rejected it. They, in winning their strike, they not only got a 5% raise for themselves, they get a 5% raise for all public sector workers. And this is really important as we talk about it. They also got some concessions in terms of their health care. They basically kick the can down the road, and there's going to be a study on that, and they're going to have the opportunity to revisit this months from now if things with the healthcare don't work out. And the irony is, of course, that Public sector workers have a limited amount of rights to strike, but because they're not really part of a union in the same sense, they don't have a collective bargaining agreement per se. They can strike whenever they want in a weird way. So, but there's a lot of different stories involved in this West Virginia strike, isn't there?
Oh, there's a lot. And, you know, I mean, let's take, for instance, just the fact that it happened in West Virginia. I just find that so fascinating because, you know, this is not a state that we consider to be some kind of, you know, public employee rich sort of place where you expect, you know, like people always talk about sort of the more elite coastal states or, you know, where you might expect to see some kind of a public employee pushback. I mean, they tried in Wisconsin, remember? I mean, just a few years ago. And that more or less, you know, failed. And Scott Walker, the miscreant, ended up, you know, sort of benefiting from the whole thing. So I think this came as a big surprise that it's happening in West Virginia. But I find it very interesting in that, you know, number one, public employees are considered by so many on the right to just be public enemy number one. And I actually hear a fair number of people that you might consider to be center left kind of look at public employees as scans. Now, normally, there are two sets of public employees that are exempted from this loathing, and that is cops and firefighters, which is a very traditionally white male aspect of the public employee, unions. The teachers, on the other hand, you know, that's actually a place where people of color, women, have sort of been dominant. So in some ways, I think when I was watching these strikers down in West Virginia, I mean, there were plenty of men, of course. I mean, there's plenty of male teachers. But the fact was is that there were a lot of women and a lot of people of color who were a part of this strike. And it just struck me that this was happening in West Virginia. This particular group of people, they are educated. But they're also very culturally identified. You could hear these people. They were all sort of, you know, I've lived in West Virginia my whole life. You know, I mean, these were not people who were like, you know, coming in from out of state. These were locals. And it was that same kind of sense I got, that weird little, you know, the hair on the back of my neck standing up and just going, you know what, there's something happening on a local level around this country of people who are just, you know, they are resisting, rebelling in this case. I mean, really rebelling. And they won. And they won because they stuck together. They pushed it as hard as they could. They did not, you know, and they were very reasonable. There was no violence. There was no ugliness about it. It was a strike, but it was, you know, very, very civil in the way that they handled it. And they won. And it's like I'm watching this going, wow, I can't believe it. You know, West Virginia, it just gives you a little bit of hope. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're right here. There's almost sort of like two... There's two parallel stories going on with this. One is that we have seen, and you could probably peg it to the Chicago teachers strike. I think it was back in 2011, which was a very successful strike. And that led to increased what they call social movement unionism as opposed to managerial unionism. And you saw in Massachusetts, Barbara Maldione became the head of the state teachers union there, and they fought off successfully attempts to privatize education via charters or expanded charters in Massachusetts. On one hand, you can see this as a... is part of that story. And on the other side of that story, we should also say that this week, teachers in Oklahoma and teachers in Arizona have cited what's going on in West Virginia as an inspiration to perhaps go on their own walkouts. In Pittsburgh, very close to West Virginia, and not, you know, within a couple hours, same media market, you saw public sector workers there able to renegotiate their contract because people were afraid of what was happening in West Virginia would be contagious in some respects. So you see this union story that is also, again, driven by women. You know, you see the teachers and nurses, frankly, have been some of the most active unions over the past several years. They also are pushing this social movement unionism because they are more attached in many respects to the community because of the nature of their jobs. And so we saw these teachers there, they're negotiating on behalf of the other public sector workers, but they're also out there talking about fracking. They're talking about health issues for members of the community. They were serving food to kids, a lot of whom only get their free meals from schools. They were doing daycare, conscious of the implications of their strike on essentially their clients. And then the other one, as you raise, is we are living in an era of unprecedented activism by women, and maybe not unprecedented, but a renewed, let's put it that way, renewed activism by women to the extent we can measure major changes in what's going on politically. And we're still, you know, a little bit out and some of these things aren't as clear, but it is we're watching women, particularly educated women, who are engaging in a way that we haven't seen in a long time. But it's all very encouraging, and we'll see where it leads. But for the moment, a good way to start off the program. We got to take a break. We'll be back with more in just a moment. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. I'm talking to the great Heather Parton. Hey, folks, Mike Papantonio's new book entitled Law and Vengeance, which is the follow-up to his critically acclaimed novel Law and Disorder, is finally out and available to you to buy. The book is a legal and political thriller drawing on Pap's experience both as a skilled trial lawyer and as a nationally syndicated political talk show host. The story follows trial lawyer Gina Romano, who was first introduced in Law and Disorder, on her quest for both vengeance and justice in a whistleblower lawsuit against a weapons manufacturer who developed and sold a dangerously defective rifle scope. Papp has built a story around real-life events that he's encountered as one of the top trial lawyers in America, where he's been fighting some of the world's largest and most corrupt corporations. Buy Mike Papantonio's new book, Law and Vengeance, today. Go to www.lawandvengeance.com. That's lawandvengeance.com. Check it out. I know you're going to love it. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Digby, we in the last segment were talking about the West Virginia teachers' strike. Very exciting, very successful. They got a lot of good reforms passed, including a 5% raise for themselves and for other public sector workers. They also dealt with some healthcare issues, and they got commitments from the governor there not to sign legislation that would encourage the privatization of public schools. And also this week, in terms of like successes for progressives and sort of capturing the grassroots activism that is happening. I mean, remember, West Virginia was marked by a situation where the leadership of the union had settled, and granted they had incentives to do so, at least nominally, because they didn't want to be susceptible to being sued in the event of an enjoinment by the courts. But then they were rebuffed by their own rank and file. And, you know, we've seen a series of stories, whether it's from The Intercept, and we've interviewed Ryan Grimm a couple of weeks about this, about progressive candidates being basically campaigned against by institutional Democrats, where it appears as if it was ideological. But also, I spoke to Lena Putnam, who did a study with Thetiscopel, and we see the same dynamic, but not necessarily from an ideological perspective. We are watching the grassroots bump up against the Democratic establishment, if you will, and it seems to be less ideological, or at least first order ideological, and more about just sort of insiders, outsiders, and the outsiders seem to want to win, and the insiders want to maintain certain, I guess, networking dynamics. And in Texas, we saw a little bit of that this week as well. You had the candidates with a lot more money lose to candidates with a lot less money, Democratic primaries I'm talking about, or get into runoffs. We saw Laura Moser in Texas, who was really openly attacked by the DCCC, get into a runoff with just with about 7 percentage points more than people anticipated she would be getting in that situation. And it really feels like something's going on here.
It does feel like it. Although, you know, when you think about it, I mean, you and I have been talking about this stuff for a long time, and this has been an ongoing problem in the party.
Definitely.
And it's a specific group. You know, the Senate campaign committee doesn't do this stuff so much. You know what I mean? I mean, they just seem to be a little bit more, you know, sensitive to what is going on in the states, and they seem to at the very least have a lighter hand with it. The DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, has for the last, you know, at least in my view, the last 18 years and probably longer than that. I guess I wasn't paying that close attention before. They have been consistently doing this. It's an institutional problem with that particular group. And what I'm seeing even, you know, and it's happened with the DNC in the past too, although I don't think that's happening from the DNC at this point. I mean, there was a lot of, you know, Sturm und Drang around the DNC, which seems to have settled down, and Tom Perez seems to be also showing a light touch in terms of the local races. It's the DCCC, and they've done it forever, and they're doing it again. And it's ridiculous because the everything about that, whatever this blue wave is that's coming, assuming that it is, and we have tons of evidence that it's happening, this is coming from grassroots, local energy, and it's not ideological. They do not need to be afraid of this. If they're afraid of it, they're afraid of democracy. Because whatever ideology is coming out, I mean, we saw it in Virginia, we see it in Texas, these people are coming at it from a very local perspective. And that means that there will be some people, like this guy in Pennsylvania, Connor Lamb, who, you know, wouldn't be my choice for a candidate. There's
right.
a lot about him that's too conservative, but in that particular district, he is probably as progressive as one would hope.
This is a special election happening on Tuesday, and I think it's the 18th district in Pennsylvania to replace Murphy, who had some rather large indiscretions and had to leave us prematurely.
Yeah, he was a pro-life candidate paying for his, he was pro-choice when it came to his own, you know, extramarital affairs.
Do
anyway,
as I say, not as I do. But we got a minute. Yeah, because I think this point is really is important.
Yeah, I mean, I just think, you know, look, you know, this what is happening in this wave is that the people of these districts, I mean, I think that the Democratic Party is far more progressive than it has been in a very long time. And to the extent it can be, I think it's being pushed by progressives in every district in the country, and they are the ones who are making these decisions. The DCCC should back off and let this happen wherever it is, whether it's California or Pennsylvania. If it's a super progressive somewhere in a blue state, let it happen. You know, stop fighting that stuff. And let this thing play out the way that it is, because this is happening. This is a spontaneous uprising, and they are doing nothing but gumming up the works. And it has nothing to do with money. This has to do with something that is actually runs deeper than money, which I think is kind of an interesting subject all into itself. But, you know, this is an old problem. And, you know, what they want to do is take credit at the end of the day, the way Rahm Emanuel did in 2006. And that's not going to happen. Nobody's going to let the DCCC take credit.
But, you know, here's the thing. Everybody likes a winner. And so if they weren't so insecure about maintaining their professional ties and padding the pockets of people who might hire them in the future, because I think it's that generic in many respects, they could just sit back and take the credit. Because everybody, if people win under your tutelage, you win and you get the credit. All right. Well, we've got to take a break. Digby, if you'll join me in the next hour, I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Just ahead, investigative journalist David Dayan explains the return of debtors' prisons. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America.
Fraud.
Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. A new ACLU report has detailed how easily it can be to put someone in jail for owing money to a company, even though it's been illegal since 1833. Here to explain how this is happening, investigative journalist David Dayan. So, David, you have a piece in The Nation magazine that is centered on a new ACLU report that suggests, and maybe suggest is perhaps too soft of a word, that we have a system of modern-day debtors' prisons in this country. Explain.
Yeah, I don't think it suggests it at all. You know, we got rid of the debtor's prison. Congress passed a law in the 1830s. Prior to that time, a majority of people who were in jails were people who hadn't paid a debt. And we decided as a country 180 years ago that that was a problem, but apparently it's not a problem anymore.
I got to stop you there. That's a fact I did not realize, that the majority of people in prisons in 1830 were there for debt. That is pretty stunning, isn't it? How was that reformed? I mean, do you know? I know this is not what your piece
is. It was a law, a federal law, that said you cannot imprison someone for solely the fact that they missed a debt payment. But what we have in place today is this situation. The report comes out of the ACLU, which, you know, has done a terrific job on this. And it really details the linkages between judges and prosecutors working with debt collection agencies to either threaten or, in some cases, actually put out arrest warrants and imprison people who have missed debts, where the debt collector gets a judgment that the debt is missing. And, you know, once you get a judgment, you can do a number of things. You can garnish wages, you can take tax refunds. But what in several states these debt collectors are doing is asking the judges to file an arrest warrant. And the warrant isn't technically for missing the debt, but the warrant is for not showing up to a hearing to assess how the individual post-judgment is going to pay. And so that's kind of how they get around this stricture. But understand that the arrest warrant would not be put out if the person didn't miss a debt. It's just sort of a technical end run around the reality here.
And that technical end run keeps it from running afoul of federal law?
Right. And so they then put out the arrest warrant for the person for missing these judgment debtor examinations. However, typically the individual doesn't even know about the judgment debtor examination. They never receive a notice of the lawsuit or whether to show up for court or when. And the debt, you know, these judgments, you know, these debt collection companies put out millions of cases trying to get judgments. And in many cases, the debt isn't even real, or it's already been paid, or it's been extinguished in bankruptcy. And none of that seems to matter. And what I really find horrible about this is the collaboration between
right.
judges who are supposed to be upholding the law and these bottom feeders in the debt collection industry. The other part of this is local prosecutor offices essentially renting out their letterhead and their office to debt collection agencies who then write letters to people who have written bad checks, threatening to arrest them because local prosecutors have the ability to arrest for bad check writing as a form of, you know, creating money, essentially, money laundering. And in some cases, these debts aren't more than like a $4 bad check. And there's no way that a district attorney would prosecute under that. However, it's using this intimidation and this potential threat to try to force people to squeeze and pay up as much as they can. So here you have prosecutor offices essentially being enlisted in debt collection, and it's really a distressing situation.
What do those prosecutorial offices get? I mean, is it simply that
they get a kickback? Of course, they get a kickback. They get some of the money for repayment should the debt collector be successful and get money back from that circumstance. So, of course,
getting
money back.
We have a situation where you have a debt collector and they're basically hiring muscle. And that muscle...
They're hiring muscle, and that muscle is the government. The government is the muscle.
Jeez.
And by the way, when the debt collector comes out and says you have to pay this back under threat of prosecution, it's not just however much money was owed within that bad check. They tack on fees. They tack on mandatory attendance in a diversion program that's usually run by the same debt collectors. It could be hundreds of extra dollars that this individual has to pay. And as I said, I mean, the complicity of what sadly passes for the justice system in this modern day debtor's prison is really the worst part.
All right. So, I mean, how widespread is this, and how is it? I just don't understand, like, how the idea that a prosecutor's office is getting a kickback, a fee, for basically intimidating people to pay their debt just seems to me to be, it has to be illegal.
You would think, but the ACLU examined, I think, over 1,000 cases in 26 states where there were arrest warrants going on. They found 8,500 arrest warrants in databases in just four states. That was Maryland, Massachusetts, Nebraska, and Utah. And then with respect to the various DA debt collector team up for these demand repayment letters, they found over 200 DA offices who are contracting with these private companies.
Wow.
On this situation. So it's not limited. It's really not an isolated incident. This is very widespread. And, you know, I applaud the ACLU for trying to put the word out about the what is really a dismaying situation.
All right. Let me one more sort of broad question about this. Well, are these companies just basically, are they just flinging this stuff out? I mean, if a lot of people don't even know, right, that they're subject to this arrest warrant, it seems to me to lose its efficacy. What is the theory? Is it just, I mean, what, I mean, I guess I understand why the debt collector would do this. They just don't care. But what do they get out of it?
Well, what ends up happening is that if someone is pulled over for anything, a traffic violation, broken taillight, they see the arrest warrant up there. And then, you know, the police are obligated sort of to turn them in. And the whole thing is just intimidation. The entire point of this is to make it so that it's so toxic to miss a debt that you never will, and that you'll do whatever you need to do borrowing from family or friends or a loan shark. I mean, I don't know, whatever you need to do to repay this company. Now, remember, these debt collectors buy this debt for pennies on the dollar. They don't have to succeed every time in order for this to be profitable for them. And, you know, the imprisonment is just another tool in the toolbox to ensure that they can make a massive profit on this.
And I imagine it's a bank shot, too. Like, we don't need, I can go and put out an arrest warrant for David Dayan, and we may never see the money from the, we may never see the money from him. But his buddy Sam Cedar is going to, you know, hear that you could go to prison for the, and Sam Cedar's going to go out and pay his debt.
There's certainly a chilling effect that is created with respect to these arrest warrants. I don't think there's any doubt about it. These obviously, this situation preys on poor communities, on communities of color, and you know, I mean, just if they're targeting such a small section of the population, you can imagine that word gets around.
Right. All right, Dave, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I got one more question on this, but I also want to talk to you about a very important Supreme Court case that took place. I want to hear about American Express versus Ohio. We got to take a quick break. I'll be right back with the great David Dayan. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now, I'm talking to my good friend David Dayan about some of his recent pieces, including his piece in The Nation, Prosecutors and Judges Have Brought Back Debtors' Prisons. So, David, when we broke, you were telling us about this report by the ACLU that you wrote about in The Nation magazine that looked at four states and the debt collection practices as it intersected with DA's offices and the courts. And it looks pretty ugly, like the essentially our government in these cases, maybe on a state level, maybe on a county level, are being used basically as the kneecappers, the muscle enforcers for debt collection by debt collection agencies. And lastly, I wanted to ask you, is there any attempts to reform this in any way?
Well, I think just the recognition and awareness of these practices being so widespread can get us to a place where they can be reformed. I mean, there are recommendations within the report. You know, the ACLU says that they violate various human rights conventions, yeah, which, it's hard to argue.
Right.
But they recommend banning arrest warrants in these debt collection cases. They recommend terminating these contracts between DAs and private debt collectors. So, you know, the roadmap is there to put a stop to this. It's just a matter of people being aware and then getting energized about getting it done.
Dickensian, America. All right, well, let's turn to some other goings-on at the Supreme Court this week. American Express versus Ohio. You flagged this in your newsletter, which I dutifully read every week. and I assume people can sign up for that at at your Tumblr site, or would they just...
tinyletter.com/DavidDayan, all one word.
tinyletter.com/DavidDayan. I don't want to give away my trade secrets about where I get all my information. But you wrote that one of the most important cases heard at the Supreme Court, and this is on a week when Janice V. AFSCME is there, which could really seriously debilitate public sector unions. You wrote that American Express versus Ohio is could very well be the most important case. Why is that? What is that case?
Well, it's an interesting case. So it involves, you know, American Express, which, as we know, gives, you know, higher rewards to individual customers. However, they charge merchants higher fees to make the transactions.
Right. Every time you go and use your credit card. Right. Every time you use your credit card.
It costs more for American Express. And that's why some companies don't actually honor American Express, some merchants. And the merchants wanted to be able to say, hey, you can buy this stick of gum, but it'll be cheaper if you use your Visa card rather than your American Express card. And they're trying to save themselves, you know, on the fees. American Express bans that. They say you are not allowed to give a discount to a customer for using a card with lower fees. And the state of Ohio took American Express to court over that. And what American Express has argued is that you can't just because – and by the way, this is an anti-competition case. They're saying that this violates competition laws to ban the merchant from doing something that can, you know, benefit them. So what American Express has said is that it doesn't matter if this hurts merchants. It also has to hurt consumers for us to put a stop to it. And because we give consumers rewards on the back end, this is not harmful to consumers, and therefore you can't prove that this is anti-competitive. And the point here is that this is about what is called a two-sided market. So American Express is serving the customer who has an American Express card and the merchant who swipes the American Express card. And what American Express is saying that is that as long as we're doing good by one of those in the two-sided market, then it does not matter. We're not, you know, violating the law. We're not violating antitrust or anti-competition laws. What this has implications for is any kind of two-sided platform, like Google, right, for example, which serves a user and also serves an advertiser. Same with Facebook or Amazon, or you can see it. And the problem is that it may be impossible to regulate big tech if American Express is successful in this lawsuit, because, you know, Google doesn't charge anything to the customer. So as long as they aren't charging the customer, they're using the customer's data to make a lot of money. But as long as they're not charging the customer, no harm, no foul. So this is a really important under the radar case that may make it impossible to regulate these companies.
It's interesting. I mean, first off, I would say that there's actually three markets, right, with, let's say, mm-hmm. YouTube and Google. There's the consumer yeah. of the YouTube, there's the advertiser, and then there's also the creator of the content. And so the issue at here is sort of the classic issue that we have in this country when in regards to antitrust. If I understand you correctly, when there was Robert Bork coming out of the University of Chicago, I believe it was, law school, basically pushed the Reagan administration into a Borkian view of antitrust, which was exclusively about how much does it cost the consumer, as opposed to looking at what we have traditionally looked at in questions of antitrust in this country, which is market power, power on the suppliers, power on the manufacturers, power in regards to even just politics writ large. Do you want a corporation getting that big that could influence policy? And so this is hugely important. I can only guess on how this is going to be resolved. Although I would imagine that it isn't as obvious as one might imagine, because the court may be sensitive to these other issues.
Yeah, it wasn't totally clear what was going to happen at the Supreme Court. Certainly, our newest justice, Neil Gorsuch, seemed to take the side of American Express. He said at one point that the occasional monopoly would be a better outcome than making an error judicially in this case, which was just quite incredible. But, you know, we'll see what happens, but it's very dangerous.
Yeah, fascinating case. All right, David Dayan, as always, a pleasure. I learn something new every time I talk to you. In many cases, I learn many new things. But thanks so much. Appreciate your coming on.
All right, thanks a lot.
David Dayan is the author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. Winner of the Studs and Ida Terkel Prize, he contributes to The Nation, The Intercept, The American Prospect, Vice, and much more. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Make sure you check out ROFpodcast.com to hear what you're missing.